From the studios of EWTN, this is Open Line. In North America, call toll-free 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 55000 or send an email to openline@ewtn.com.
A tremendous Thursday to each and every one of you. Thanks so much for tuning in to EWTN's Open Line. If you would like to be part of the program, pick up the phone and give us a call. The number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, we've got a number for you. It's 1-205-271-2985. And we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. And you can always send us an email. The email address is openline@ewtn.com. I'm Jack Williams, Pedro Quiles producing the program. Your call screener is Matt Gubensky and Michael McCall watching our social media feeds. The main call-in number can also be used to text your question to us. That number again, 833-288-3986. When we signed off yesterday, I told you that we had a very special surprise for you in Father Gerald Murray's absence today. And those of you that have been watching from the beginning on YouTube have probably been checking your watches and looking at your calendars and making sure that you're in the right place at the right time. But Dr. David Anders, the host of Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders, it's kind of a clever title for a show, is going to sit in today for Father Gerald Murray. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jack. How about you?
Are you a priest?
I'm not a priest.
Are
well,
you a can-
I'm a priest according to my baptismal priesthood.
Are you a ministerial priest?
I am not a ministerial priest.
Are you a canon lawyer?
I am most certainly not a canon lawyer.
Yeah, we'll just have to get by.
Yeah.
833-288-EWTN is our phone call. We'll get to some emails in a second, but I want to go to Jonathan because he was gracious enough to hold on between shows. He's a first-time caller in the great state of North Dakota listening on Real Presence Radio. Jonathan, you are on with Dr. David Anders. Welcome to the program.
Hello, hello.
Hey there. What's your question?
So my wife and I were married in the Catholic Church and did everything, like all the classes and everything like that, I guess. We're now recently divorced, and I just was just curious the process, if there is a remarriage possibility or not at all, I guess, just kind of the process that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. I really appreciate the question. So if you wanted to marry again in the Catholic Church, it would be necessary for you to request an annulment or at least an investigation into the validity of your previous marriage. Christ said that what God has joined together, man cannot separate. So a valid marriage cannot be separated for any reason by any authority. It's till death do us part. But it is often the case that people represent themselves as having been in valid marriages, and it turns out there was something essential lacking to the marriage that would render it invalid if under investigation. And you really can't prejudge that. You have to submit that to the judgment of the marriage tribunal of the diocese. They know what the impediments are. An impediment is, you know, something that would invalidate a marriage. And they can look into your case and discern whether or not there were any impediments. There are quite a few that can qualify to render the judgment that, no, there actually wasn't a marriage there to begin with. The one that's most commonly put forth is that the people who made the commitment at the beginning were not psychologically mature enough to make the commitment that they made for one reason or another. And if you can't really enter into that kind of covenant freely with your eyes wide open and, you know, with rational deliberation, then you got no business making it. And that would be a grounds for nullity. But there are other grounds as well, and that's the job of the tribunal. So anyway, that's my advice to you, is if you're divorced and there's no possibility of reconciliation, talk to your priest about the possibility of obtaining an annulment, if that is possible. And if the tribunal comes back with that verdict, then that would free you up to marry in the Catholic Church again.
So let me ask you a question that a lot of people have. This is not necessarily Jonathan's question, but just it's a good time to bring it up while we're talking about it. Suppose Jonathan and his recently divorced spouse have children, and one of them goes through the process, and that marriage was declared null.
Right.
Does not illegitimize the children, does it?
No. I mean, the concept of illegitimacy is a little bit anachronistic and archaic. I mean, because in older cultures, illegitimacy as a concept was used to exclude kids from certain rights or privileges within social institutions, and that really doesn't pertain anymore. I mean, there's nothing that would be open to a child that would be closed because their parents were or weren't married. So it's almost a category that doesn't exist anymore. But yeah, no, the church does not consider your children illegitimate if your marriage is declared invalid.
God bless you, Jonathan. Thanks so much for the call today. 833-288-3986 is our toll-free number. Are you familiar with the fine-tuned universe argument?
I am.
Josh wants to know if the existence of God can be proven by it.
Nope. It could be suggested by it. I mean, that's the way it's presented. So, I mean, the idea behind the fine-tuned universe theory is that the physical constants necessary to sustain our form of life, our form of intelligence, are so particular that the slightest variation in the physical structure of the universe would render life impossible. And yet here we are. And doesn't that suggest some sort of, if there's fine-tuning, doesn't that suggest a fine-tuner, right? I'd say that's consistent with Christian theism. And it's sufficient to awaken your moral imagination to the possibility that there could be a God. God, an intelligent God, is a creative God, is a plausible explanation for that phenomenon. But it's not logically entailed by it. I mean, you can come up with any number of metaphysical hypotheses that are logically compatible with the fine-tuned universe. I won't enumerate them because you just have to tune into some atheist websites and you'll find them. So I don't think it constitutes proof. I think it's suggestive. That's the best you can do.
You remember Dolly the sheep?
That was the cloned sheep, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Daniel wants to know, I know cloning humans is wrong. Is cloning animals unethical?
We should not be wantonly cruel to animals. I mean, that's part of Catholic moral catechesis. One of the things that can happen with any sort of genetic experimentation is you can create monsters, right, who live miserable lives. And so, I think it would be wrong to be profligate with that kind of technology. But it's not intrinsically immoral for the same reasons that it would be intrinsically immoral to clone humans, because humans are made in the likeness and image of God and have a moral worth and dignity and moral status that's different from the life of animals. I mean, it's not intrinsically immoral to raise animals for slaughter. It would absolutely be intrinsically immoral to raise humans for slaughter.
Yeah. Have you heard these notions going on? I don't know how real they are. I think some of them have actually been experienced, but this whole use of genetically modified insects as sort of agricultural warfare?
Yeah, I've heard something about that. You know, I mean, so if your formal intent is genocidal, well, that would vitiate anything that you were doing.
833-288-3986. Kyle says, my friend believes that he has been cursed by an ancestor who was a Mason. How can I comfort and clarify the truth for this person?
Right. So the idea of ancestral curses is an idea that has entered into popular discourse largely from charismatic Protestantism, and the International Association of Catholic Exorcists encounters this claim quite frequently and issued an authoritative statement within the last 5 years to the effect that this is no part of the Catholic patrimony. It's not part of Catholic tradition. It's not the way the Catholic Church thinks about malevolent spiritual influence and shouldn't form a part of Catholic pastoral practice. So I would say that somebody who has this notion essentially has inherited a superstitious notion that's not the way Catholic Church thinks about this. Now, that's not to say that if you have relatives or ancestors that are into bad stuff, that can't end up hurting you. I mean, yeah, it can. I mean, simple example. I mean, you have parents that are drug addicts, they're not going to be good parents. If you have parents that are into, you know, pagan mystery cults, they're not going to be good parents for different reasons. So it can still affect you, but it's not going to affect you because you've caught some contagion that gets passed on esoterically.
Just getting started on a Thursday edition of EWTN's Open Line. Dr. David Anders sitting in for Father Gerald Murray today. If you'd like to be part of the program, pick up the phone and give us a call. The number's 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Straight ahead, we'll talk to Jasenia in San Antonio, Joe in the great state of Iowa, and we've got plenty of time for your calls as well. 833-288-3986. It's Open Line Thursday with Dr. David Anders sitting in for Father Gerald Murray.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. If you have a question, call 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. Or send us an email to openline@ewtn.com.
It's Thursday night. That means the world over with Raymond Arroyo. Each week, Raymond challenges viewers with important political and cultural reporting and analysis of a wide variety of topics of interest to Catholics and people of faith. That's the world over with Raymond Arroyo tonight, 8 Eastern time, right here on EWTN Radio and Television. Still some open phone lines for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Next up is Jasenia in San Antonio, Texas, listening today on Guadalupe Radio. Jasenia, how badly did I butcher your name?
No, it sounded great. You did good.
Awesome. What's your question today?
Okay, so my question is, in the Ten Commandments, our father at church, the priest has said that there should be a certain way that they're listed for it to make it, I guess, like a Catholic edition. And so my husband was actually, he found some wall art, and it was the Ten Commandments, and he's like, I'd like this in our home. And I was like, oh, that's nice, right? So, but we saw that number 5 was thou shalt not kill. So then a friend of ours was like, well, that's not Catholic. So I was like, and then I know, again, like the priest at our church has also mentioned, I guess, the Ten Commandments being a certain way for it to be considered like a Catholic edition. So we opened up our Bible, but we noticed that Exodus, in Exodus, it's number 5 is, hold on, I think I just butchered my whole question.
You know, I understand the dilemma.
So in the Catholic Bible,
I understand the dilemma that you have, and so I'll just go ahead and jump to the point and answer it, and I appreciate the question a lot. So it is true that Protestants and Catholics enumerate the Ten Commandments differently. Now, one thing that's important to note is that in sacred scripture, there's no enumeration. The Bible just lists a bunch of imperatives. And it doesn't say, you remember the count from Sesame Street? No, number one. You know, the Bible doesn't go number one, number two. It doesn't do that, right? And so, tradition has assigned an enumeration that implies a logical relationship between the commandments. And it really boils down to one or two major issues between the Protestant, well, really it's the Calvinist tradition and the Catholic tradition. And here's the distinction. In Calvinism, which is a form of Protestantism, they take what Catholics understand to be the first commandment, and they break it into two. So the first commandment is, I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me, and you shall not make any graven images. So the logical connection is that making graven images is a type of having gods other than the Lord. The way the Calvinist tradition does it is commandment number 1, don't have any other gods. Commandment number 2, don't make any graven images. So they separate making graven images from the singular command, don't have any other gods. And they use that as a justification for iconoclasm. That is to say, the rejection of religious artwork. And so it was standard. If you went into Reformed churches in the 16th century or 17th century for that matter, they would have whitewashed walls, no artwork or visual representations of any kind. And they regarded the visual artwork that Catholics used, paintings, statuary, etc., as violations of what they called the Second Commandment and as species of idolatry. All right. Naturally, the Catholic Church doesn't read it that way. Now, one of the consequences of the Calvinist enumeration is if you're going to come up with 10 commandments, you're going to have to conflate two others. And so what they conflated were what the Catholic Church considers to be Commandment 9 and 10. Commandment 9 is don't covet your neighbor's wife. Commandment 10 is don't covet his stuff. Now, in Calvinism, those are one command. The Catholic looks at that and says, okay, so you're lumping my wife together with my possessions. That implies something about the way you're regarding my wife. And it reminds me, actually, of Homer's Odyssey. If you remember, Odysseus is on the island with Calypso, the nymph, and he wants to go home to his patrimony. And we romantic 20th century people read that story and go, oh, he wants to go home and see his wife. Ah, he's not in, that's not, you forget in the narrative, he and Calypso, like, get busy before he leaves. Like, it's not about fidelity to his wife. He just wants his stuff. His wife is part of the stuff. It's like his hunting dog, his rifle, his tennis racket, his Xbox, you know, and his wife. They all get lumped in together, right? And that's kind of what seems to be implied by the Calvinist enumeration. Don't covet your neighbor's stuff, including his wife. Well, my wife is not part of my stuff. She is an integral human being with her own autonomy and dignity. And my respect for her and my neighbor's wife is of an entirely different order from, say, my desire to covet or not covet his Xbox. So there's a logic to the way the Catholic Church organizes this. Now, you know, I mean, if you're hanging something on your wall and it gives all this information, I mean, it says basically the content of the commandments, you know, I wouldn't get too hung up on about it as long as it's edifying to you. But that's the logic behind the distinction in the Catholic Church.
Does that help a little bit?
It does help a little bit. And I guess, like, the main question was, is the way it's numbered, is there an importance to it? Because that was my argument with my husband was like, I mean, we got to follow all 10, so what does it matter if it's out of order?
Well, the only way it matters would be if the commandments on coveting differentiate wife and goods, right? That enumeration matters, and if you list not making graven images as a distinct commandment, you risk breaking that out from the logic of the first commandment, which is the unique worship of the Lord. And, you know, and it doesn't guarantee, but it would raise the specter of Calvinism and iconoclasm.
God bless you, Jacinta. Thank you so much for the phone call today. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Next stop is the great state of Iowa. Joe, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Joe, you are on with Dr. David Anders.
Hey there. Thank you very much for taking my call. I have a question. I just recently learned that a pretty influential member of one of my local parishes has some disturbing, I would say at the least, views on the church in either recognizing or rejecting certain doctrines and like popes and stuff like that. But he's citing Epikeia as his excuse to maintain receiving the sacraments and maintaining his relationship with that parish. And I'm just wanting to know, like, how far does Epikeia go? Like, is he covered? Is he right?
I really appreciate the question. So let's define the terms for the sake of the listeners. Epikeia is a classical virtue, which is the virtue of knowing when not to follow the letter of the law. And Jesus practiced Epikeia. A good example would be John chapter 8, when the Pharisees bring him a woman caught in the act of adultery, and the letter of the law said she should be stoned, and Christ refrains from carrying out the execution, right? He exercised epikeia and said there is a justice in not following justice, strictly according to the letter of the law. You know, I think I read the other day about a court case where, you know, a woman was cited for theft because she had stolen medications from a pharmacy. And when she's like 90 years old and she shows up in front of the judge and he says, what happened? And she said, well, you know, my husband needs this medication to stay alive. And I show up at the pharmacy to pick it up and the insurance wasn't going to cover it. And I don't have the money. And if I don't get it for him, he's going to die. And so the pharmacist turned her back and I grabbed it and made for the door. But I'm 90, so I wasn't going too fast and they busted me, you know. And the judge said, I'm not going to prosecute a 95-year-old woman who's, you know, grabbing the heart medication for her dying husband. I mean, something's wrong with our culture that we would be in this situation at all, right? And he made the decision in epikeia to not throw the book at the 95-year-old woman who's just trying to save her husband's life. That's an example of epikeia. Now, I mentioned at the outset that epikeia is a virtue, right? A virtue is a skill that you acquire through practice. It's not just a single-minded decision in radical freedom to do whatever the heck you want, right? And it has to be acquired, you know, with a certain sensitivity to prudence and to the real virtues of justice and temperance and fortitude. And in a Catholic context, faith, hope, and charity has to be moderated by these things, by concept of the dignity of the human person and so forth. So it's not just a carte blanche to do whatever you want. You know, you can be a selfish, hedonistic narcissist and try to justify it by claiming epikeia, we're not going to let you off the hook, right, for that. Now, when it comes to Catholic doctrine, the Church itself tells us that there is a sort of hierarchy in the terms of the kind of consent that we have to offer to magisterial statements. There are some things that we have to accept with divine and supernatural faith. There are other things that we have to accept because they are logically entailed by dogmatic truths. There are other truths that to which we have to grant what's called a religious submission of mind and will without actually making the assent of faith. And the religious submission of mind and will is basically, so let's say the Pope says something in his capacity of the ordinary magisterium, and maybe we think it's a bit off, and it's not a dogma, but we recognize that he's the Pope and we're not, and so he gets to be the guy that sort of has the official position in this in the Catholic Church, and we're going to respect that and respect our, you know, relative position in the Church. But in my inner sanctum, you know, in my conscience, I may not fully agree with it, but I'm going to show respect to the Pope and his office, and I'm not going to maybe make a big scandal about it in public. That'd be religious submission of mind. And well, and there's other places in the Church where, you know, the Pope or the bishops or the priest does something, and it was just, you know, completely stupid and horrible and terrible, and we're permitted to say that, right? The amount of freedom that we can occupy is actually fairly broad. And one of my favorite historical examples is Cardinal Newman, now Doctor of the Church, St. John Henry Newman, who in the 19th century was a noted inopportunist with respect to the First Vatican Council. What does that mean? First Vatican Council defined the dogma of papal infallibility. Newman believed the dogma of papal infallibility. He thought that it was true. He thought it was true that the Pope was infallible. However, he thought that it was unwise for the Church to define the dogma at that time. That's a pretty nuanced position. True, but maybe you don't have to say all true things. So I haven't quite got to the point of your question yet, and Jack is giving me the shut up, Anders. We're going to a break sign. Hold that thought. I will answer it succinctly on the other side of the break.
And straight ahead, we'll talk to Alvaro in Yakima, Washington, Dawn in Springfield, Missouri. And we've got plenty of time for your calls as well. 833-288-3986. It's EWTN's Open Line Thursday with Dr. David Anders sitting in for Father Gerald Murray.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
This week, let's celebrate EWTN radio affiliate WWGL FM 97.9, serving the great city of Steubenville, Ohio, the home of Franciscan University. They've been on the air now for 11 years. Congratulations to all the fine folks at WWGL from your friends here at EWTN radio. We are talking to Joe in the great state of Iowa, and Dr. Anders, you were getting to the end of your point.
Which was whether or not the virtue of epikeia can justify wholesale dissent from magisterial teaching. And so I laid out a lot of conditions under which you can withhold consent to magisterial actions. But at the end of the day, the church defines certain things as dogmas. If you formally deny those dogmas, and you do so understanding that the church defines them as dogmas, then you are what is called a formal heretic. And you will be subject to excommunication, and you will not be in communion with the church. Now, you know, a person could be formally a heretic privately and not make a big deal out of it, and the church would never know, and so you might not be subject to a formal decree of excommunication. But it doesn't mean you're not in trouble, right? It's still a problematic. I mean, the church defines dogmas for a reason, because they're healthful to us. They're good for us to know and to understand and believe. And assessing the degree of personal culpability, you know, how much does this person understand? How much is this willful disobedience or obstinacy? That's really beyond our pay grade. I mean, the church operates in the objective realm. It can't really get too deeply into the subjective interests and motives of individuals, except in the confessional. But it has to maintain the integrity of the church. And so when someone becomes a notorious heretic and they formally deny a dogma and they make a big deal out of it and they make a big splash, well, then they get excommunicated.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. We head next to Yakima, Washington. Alvaro is listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Alvaro, you're on with Dr. David Anders.
Hi, Dr. David Anders.
Howdy.
I just had a quick question. I am wanting to study apologetics, and I've been wanting to know if there is any book that may contain the important letters for that subject of the Church Fathers.
Sure. So there are many collections of the Church Fathers that are extant and available. The most comprehensive is one that you have no interest in. There's a classic 400 volume collection by Mean, the Patrologia Latina and Graeca, which have all the major works of the Church Fathers for basically the first 1,000 years. But that's for scholars. In English, in the 19th century, there was an American Reformed theologian, Protestant theologian named Philip Schaff, who put together a very widely disseminated collection of the works of the fathers translated into English. His name was Philip Schaff. And the Schaff edition of the Church Fathers is not comprehensive. I mean, it's extensive, but it's nothing like the scope of Mean. But it's widely available. And so, for example, there's a Catholic website, newadvent.org, that has all of the Schaff edition searchable online. I make reference to that quite frequently. I personally have a hardbound copy of the Schaff edition in my house that I almost never consult. Because the print is small and it's so much easier to read online, but I do have it and I used to consult it, and I've got an ebook version as well that I also don't consult because the apparatus is complicated and it's hard to find what you want. It's easier just to go online. But those are resources, and then you can find modern editions that are academic, and then you can find compilations from Catholic publishers that are, you know, be smaller collections here and there. But let me give you a piece of advice about this project. Don't aim for comprehensive, right? And I'll tell you why. Because the writings of the fathers are highly uneven, and they're not all equally important. And the individual fathers are not equally important, and what they write is not all equally important. So it's better to get a sense for who the most important thinkers are, and what their most important works are, and go at it that way, right? And so I'll just tell you right off the bat who you need to read. In the Latin Church, the two voices that you need to read and understand more than anybody else is St. Augustine of Hippo, and he's not a father, although he is a doctor, Thomas Aquinas. If all you did was learn Augustine and Thomas, I mean, you've got your work cut out for you for the rest of your life. You'll never master them. And there's more material there than you can ever wrap your head around. When it comes to the particular works, you need to start with Augustine's Confessions, which is not only a great piece of theological writing, but it's one of the great works of Western literature. It's the first intellectual autobiography in history, and it's just absolutely tremendous.
Entertaining as all get
out. Thomas's Summa Theologica is a masterpiece of theological erudition and compression. It's long, and you need some introduction to it, so get a hold of a book like Ed Fazer's Aquinas to learn the philosophical background to make sense of it. You need to familiarize yourself with the major Greek thinkers that are called the Cappadocians. So that's St. Basil the Great and Gregory Nazianzus and Gregory of Nyssa, as well as St. John Chrysostom. You need to, who else in the West would I really pay attention to? St. Bonaventure gives you a completely different take on scholasticism than St. Thomas. So, I mean, these are the kind of people that you need to get familiar with. And then as you begin to read their works, they'll quote other authors as they move along, and you'll think, oh, well, maybe I need to explore this, explore that. And you'll begin to build your database outwards. But focus on the majors, because they're really, it's these guys whose doctrines come to define the dogmatic tradition, and that's really what we're trying to lay a hand on. Now, I could talk to you for about another hour about who the other thinkers are that you're going to eventually encounter, but start there.
God bless you, Alvaro. Good luck in your studies. 833-288. EWTN's our toll-free number. Don is up next in Springfield, Missouri, listening on Catholic Radio Network. Don, thanks for holding. You're on with Dr. Anders.
Hello, Dr. Anders. I love listening to you.
Thank you so much.
You teach us a lot. I had the opportunity to evangelize a little bit yesterday with a Protestant, and two things came up. One was, if we believe in the true body, blood, soul, and divinity of Christ in the bread and the wine, and Christ said, do both of those in remembrance of me, why are we able to only do one or the other during Mass? And then the second thing is, when Christ said to Peter, whatever sins are forgiven and retained, etc., the Protestant guy said, well, that if you guys believe that he was the first pope, then Christ gave the pope the power to forgive sin, but not the priests. So I need both of those answered.
Sure.
I told him I didn't know the answer. I'd get it, and that's why I'm calling.
The first question, when you say, why do we only do one? I think what you mean is you're talking about the lay reception of only the consecrated host as opposed to the host and the chalice. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, we can only do one. I mean, we can do both, but we are able to do just one if we choose to.
The question involves a misunderstanding of the nature of the double consecration. Why the consecration of bread and wine? So I will ask you this question rhetorically. Why does Jesus give us communion in two kinds? Why? Is it because he wants us to have something to drink with our food? And as soon as you put the question, you realize that's absurd. No, of course not. That's got nothing to do with it. The reason that we have communion in two kinds is that the Eucharist, while it is Christ's true body and blood, is also a symbol. Yes, I said that. It is both his true body and blood, and it's a symbol. What is symbolized by the Eucharist? What's symbolized by the double consecration is precisely the separation of his body from his blood. Bread over here, wine over there. Body over here, blood over there. What does that show? It shows what happened to Jesus at Calvary, what happened on the cross. His body was separated from his blood. That is to say, he was right and truly dead. So that's why the Mass, excuse me, I'm losing my voice. The Mass is the memorial of Christ's death and resurrection. That's the language the Mass uses about itself. That end, that purpose of the double consecration to symbolize the separation of Christ's body from his blood, is fully realized in the act of consecration. The purpose for which God gave us two kinds, is fully realized in the act of consecration. The minute the priest says, this is my body, this is my blood, and shows forth these elements in a state of separation, it's satisfied. The communion is something completely separate. And the Council of Trent said in its catechism, the Eucharist as a sacrifice, and that's to say what happens in the consecration, and the Eucharist as a sacrament are two different things. They're very distinct, and the distinction is very great. And so the question, because Protestants don't have a doctrine of Eucharistic sacrifice, they conflate everything to the act of communion. And so the question suggests that the only purpose, the only goal of Eucharistic ministry, Eucharistic worship, is communion. And that's just false. That's just false. The principle, the primordial purpose of the Eucharist is to have a perpetual sacrifice wherein the division of Christ's body from blood is forever shown forth so that what happens on Calvary is represented there on the altar. That's done. Now, when it comes to the communion, well, I want to receive Jesus. And that I fully realize if I receive in one kind or in two.
And the
second question was...
And just to reinforce your point, our obligation is to attend Mass,
not to receive communion. Exactly. We have an obligation to receive communion
once a year.
Now, Christ did give the power of binding and loosing to all the apostles. He says this twice, Matthew 16, Matthew 18. Matthew 16, he says to Peter. Matthew 18, he says it to all of them. So again, the question is based on a false premise.
God bless you, Don. Thanks so much for the question today. Mary's up next, a first-time caller in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, listening on Oklahoma Catholic Radio. Mary, you are on with Dr. David Anders.
Oh, yes, hi. I had a question regarding what would be considered legitimate use of natural family planning. And the situation is this. Two people want to get married, and they want to get married in the church. The woman has very serious mental health issues, and she has to stay on her medications. If she were to go off of them, she would deteriorate very rapidly. And if she were to stay on them and she were to conceive, it could be very, it could result in a lot of problems for the unborn child. And then there's also the issue of if she were to try to raise a child, it may throw her into a real tailspin. So they decided that they do want to be married and they'd like to continue their Catholic faith, but they're in a situation where they need to avoid pregnancy. And of course, to get married in the Catholic Church, you have to be open to life. So that sort of presents a dilemma. So,
yes, it does.
They thought about natural family planning. But I don't know if the purpose of natural family planning, our understanding is that it's to space children, not to avoid permanently not having children.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know the couple. I'm not advising them. I'm not educating them. I really would give it more as general advice rather than particular to their situation. But, you know, just generally, if someone came to me and said, you know, I'm not probably a safe mother, then I would say, then I think you need to seriously consider whether you're really called to the vocation of marriage, right? I mean, I've known people who, for whatever reason, they recognize that door shut to them. I mean, maybe not biologically, but there are reasons why, you know, I'm not a person who needs to have kids. And then that means I'm a person who doesn't need to marry. And I recognize that's a cross. I mean, we all have crosses. We all have crosses. Some of them are quite hard to bear, and it seems terribly unjust. I know I feel this way. You know, something happens in my life, and I look over at Jack, and he's just thriving, you know? And I'm like, why does Jack get all the good luck, you know? Why did you roll the dice this way? And, of course, God doesn't roll dice, of course. And we all have that sense. And you know, learning how to cope with that. I don't want to be in this situation. I don't want to have this lot in life. I wish I'd had other parents or other kids or, other disabilities, and why did I have to get these? And it's not fair. It's not fair. It's not fair. And, you know, like our grandparents told us, who told you life was going to be fair? I mean, learning how to cope with that, bear the cross, accept the what God's providence sends us, just is the path of sanctification. And it's really hard, and it's made all the harder because we live in a terribly romanticized culture that teaches us that we all have this intrinsic right, not just to happiness, but to our own highly idiosyncratic sense of pleasures, right? That the way I want to construct my happiness is somehow my due in life, and it isn't. It isn't. So, I mean, that's first thought. I was like, it is really problematic. Now, secondly, you're correct. If they go in absolutely closed off to the possibility of life, then it's not a valid marriage. So, but there is maybe a tiny sliver of a workaround, not really a workaround, but a work through, and it's this. I need to know more, and they need to talk to their pastor, and they need to talk to a doctor, and so this is really general stuff here. So don't take it as gospel truth. But medications change all the time in mental health care, and some medications are compatible with pregnancy, and some aren't. And so explore with your pastor, like, right now, given our medical situation today, this is not an option for us. Maybe you need to wait. That's the first question. But, you know, it's very possible it could change 5 years from now, 10 years from now. Can I enter into the estate of marriage with the intent to have children as soon as it becomes medically advisable? You know, I mean, that's not completely forestalling consent. Does raise the pastoral question of, well, do you need to wait that long, right? But you see, there's maybe a tiny little sliver of possibility there. But I really would seriously think about this, right? Because they're asking themselves for a world of hurt.
The marriage, R-I-T-E, is not an R-I-G-H-T.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. God bless you, Mary. Thanks for your concerned heart. Joseph is up next, a first-time caller in Louisiana, listening on Christ Our King Radio. Joseph, you're on with Dr. Anders.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, how's it going?
All right, how about you?
Oh, doing great. I got a question. I was married. She wanted a divorce, so I gave a divorce. And I met a friend. She was divorced, but her husband passed. So we're good friends. And we don't have, you know, no relationship. We barely hug once in a while, but we're good friends. And we live on, well, she has her house, I have mine, but I go back and forth and we sleep separate rooms. We don't, you know, she goes change over there, I change over here, you know, in my bathroom. Sooner or later, we're going to probably have to live in one house. So my question is, where does the church stand on that?
Yeah, so cohabitation between men and women who are not married is generally frowned on as a bad idea and definitely puts one in the near occasion of sin. Can there be historical exceptions to that rule? Yeah, of course. I mean, if you live in some deeply impoverished situation where there's limited housing and, you know, you're forced by some sort of necessity to live in close proximity with people that you're not married to, and it's really not a matter of choice for you, it's a matter of survival. I mean, those kinds of situations do arise. But as a matter of prudential choice, that's not advisable. So my question would be, her previous spouse died, you had a divorce. I don't know if you've pursued the possibility of an annulment. And if you guys want to live together, why not investigate the question of the status of your previous marriage and your eligibility to marriage in the Catholic Church, and then explore that as an option, right? Otherwise, you talked about the necessity of living together. At some point, it will become necessary for us to share one house. I don't see that that's necessary at all. I mean, if you've got economic constraints and you can't afford the house by yourself, well, you can downscale or get a roommate. I don't know why you would have to live with your girlfriend.
I would suggest, not knowing all of the details of Joseph's situation, but if he's a divorced man in the Catholic Church, he's not free to be engaged in a relationship like this to begin with.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
833-288-EWTN's our toll-free number. Word on Fire, every Sunday afternoon at 4 Eastern Time, Bishop Robert Barron illustrates the truth, beauty and goodness of Catholicism as few can. That's Word on Fire, Sunday afternoons at 4 p.m. Eastern, right here on EWTN Radio. Chris is up next in Omaha, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Chris, you're on with Dr. David Anders.
Yeah, Dr. David Anders, I had a question for you. Often engage a lot of my Protestant friends, you know, who are firm believers in the rapture and so forth, which we don't necessarily believe in like they do. And, you know, they always cite the verse, Revelation 3:10, where, you know, those that are faithful are going to be kept, you know, from the tribulation and so forth, right? What are we to make of that verse as Catholics, you know, what that verse means and how maybe they're perceiving that in error to arrive at their pre-tribulation type rapture thing?
Yeah, well, thank you. I really appreciate the question. First of all, Revelation chapter 3, in that passage, Christ is very explicit that he's writing to the church in Philadelphia. He doesn't say anything about the church universally. So, presumably, the church in Philadelphia did not undergo the trial that struck the rest of the Roman Christian world in the first century. I mean, that was Christ's promise. This was writing about contemporary events. I'm guessing the church in Philadelphia got a pass, right? Not everybody did. And we know that early Christians suffered tremendously under the various persecutions, but evidently the Philadelphians were spared because that's what Jesus said he was going to do. Secondly, in promising to keep the Philadelphians free from the hour of trial, he doesn't say a word in there about translating them out of space and time to a holding tank in heaven for 7 years. Doesn't say a word about that. Doesn't say a word about about three comings of Jesus, the incarnation, you know, the coming judgment and glory at the end, and then some sort of secret coming in the middle. Doesn't say anything about that at all. All these are parts of the Protestant rapture doctrine. So I don't think that Revelation 3:10 has anything at all to do with the Protestant doctrine of the rapture. The Protestant doctrine of the rapture emerged in the 19th century out of a peculiar problem. And it was one that was posed by fundamentalism, because fundamentalists have a literal hermeneutic of the Bible where they take every individual proposition in its straightforward denotative sense. And because in the Old Testament you find prophecies about the future glory of Israel and Jerusalem and its kings and its relationship to the pagan and the Gentile world, fundamentalists who read the Bible very literally said, well, you know, if God says that Jerusalem is going to be glorified and other nations are going to bring tribute to the king in Zion, then that must literally happen. It did not happen in Jesus' ministry. Jesus did not set himself up as an earthly king in that matter. So it must happen sometime in the future, right? But there's nothing about that in the Bible other than these prophecies in Isaiah and Ezekiel and so forth. So we have to invent an eschatology. We have to come up with a theory to explain how all this fits together. And if that's the way it's going to happen, then why on earth did Jesus create this other kind of entity that doesn't involve these geopolitical conquests? And the language that they invented was that the church that Christ founded was a kind of parenthesis. They use that language. They call it a historical parenthesis between this covenant of Israel at the beginning of time and then this fulfillment to Israel at the end. Well, if the church is a parenthesis in what is otherwise a kind of Hebraic vision of the eschaton, what are you going to do with the church? What are you going to do with the church? And so they invent the idea that the church gets pulled out of space and time through the so-called rapture, and they go poking around in the Bible trying to find texts that could support this idea, and they pull some out of context that do not have anything to do with that, but they take a particular phrase in a completely arbitrary way and try to squeeze it into that theory. But it's ultimately in service of a faulty biblical hermeneutic, which is this fundamentalist literalism that the New Testament knows nothing about, and therefore the Christian tradition knows nothing about. And Protestants don't know anything about it either until the 19th century. So the rapture is not a Catholic doctrine. It's not a biblical doctrine. It's not even a classically Protestant doctrine. It's just a fundamentalist doctrine that emerges in Anglo-American Protestantism in the 19th century.
And in the interest of time, I can't get all the details because we're just out of time, Catherine. But Catherine in Oklahoma, listening on Oklahoma Catholic Broadcasting, said she was in a store. She was very uncomfortable when a woman pulled out oil, started anointing and praying over her. And she wants to know Should she have been uncomfortable, or is it just her?
You're perfectly within your rights to be uncomfortable. You know, in certain forms of charismatic Protestantism, they read St. James's admonition to call for the elders and have them anoint you with oil as a kind of carte blanche to, you know, get people really messy really fast, you know, and like that has some sort of intrinsic power apart from the sacraments. They don't have a theology of the sacraments, but they have these kinds of gestures. And to me, it's an imposition, and if he didn't want it to happen, it actually probably constitutes tortious assault. But I'm not a lawyer, you know, so yeah, I think you're perfectly within your rights to be uncomfortable.
David, thanks so much for sitting in today.
Thank you, Jack.
On behalf of our host, Dr. David Andrews, on behalf of Father Gerald Murray, our producer, Pedro Quiles, and our call screener, Matt Gubensky, and our social media maven, Mr. Michael McCall, I'm Jack Williams. Thanks so much for tuning in to EWTN's Open Line Thursday. Back at it tomorrow with our very own Vice President of Theology, Colin Donovan. Until then, God bless.